politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we look at critical media literacy education, but we look at different facets of it, something called constructive media literacy and education. We'll be joined by Ken Burrows and San Francisco State University students to discuss this among the stories they've been researching. Later in the program, we're joined by Chase Palmieri of Tryworthy.com, and we'll discuss a new online platform that deals with crowd-contested media. Please stay with us.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsed.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're going to begin by talking about constructive media versus problem-focused media, or constructive possibility media. And we're joined by returning guest Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University. Ken, in addition to being a longtime lecturer there, Ken also helps run the San Francisco Project Censored Club. And the students at San Francisco State University have long contributed stories to Project Censored. And we have, again, the pleasure of welcoming several of Ken's students that have participated in the research processes for our books, including the next one that Andy Lee Roth and I are working on right now, called Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. We are also joined by Bethany Surface, and she's going to be talking about some of the stories that she's been researching. We have Bethany joining us by phone. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, how's it going?
It's wonderful. Great to have you on the program. In studio, we have with us Malcolm Pinson, and Malcolm is going to talk to us about one of the stories he researched, and this is a really fascinating one on preventing police brutality. But before we get into the specifics, later, by the way, we'll be joined by Audrey Johnson, but let's start with you, Ken Burrows, and let's talk about constructive media literacy, and let's talk about how you help guide some of the research that goes on with the students at San Francisco State.
Glad to. At Project Censored SF State, we focus to some degree on constructive news, which is basically about exploring solutions and creative possibilities within our communities. We feel this is really a game-changing idea, and really it expands what media literacy is and can be. And just to say a little bit about it, we humans are mental creatures. We basically have evolved over 600 million years to be fearful. And to learn how to avoid hazards, it's been essential to our survival. And that threat awareness has kept our ancestors, has kept us alive. But it's what biologists call the negativity bias. It has a cost. It leaves us fear-based and fear-biased in our thinking, and it dominates our cultural perspective because of that. So our minds and behaviors are now shaped by these perceived threats, real and unreal. And this leads to two core mistakes: overestimating the problems, and really underestimating resources and possibilities. So if you look at most media, most news, it's really this, it's about what we fear. It's basically, we're a problem-fixated journalism. It fails to cover the vast amount of human behavior that tends to be collaborative and caring. And I mean, every day we solve problems as human beings.
That's right, Ken Burrows. And of course, while we do need to understand the challenges and do need to understand how problems arise, it is very important that we spend more time talking about the collaboratory forces that you just mentioned and the different kind of frame and different focus for a new kind of media and telling new kinds of stories about our possibilities.
So would you like to hear about those four types?
Please tell us, Ken.
So basically, we're seeing four cornerstones of this expanded media literacy model. First is the standard model of critical thinking. It's a problem-focused news. It's essential. There we learn about the facts. It's about the who, the what, the when, and the where to become aware of, about possible threats, concerns that we can either prevent or resist. But that tends to dominate the news, and we tend to be overly reporting that and under-reporting these three other possible news sources. So one is solution-based news. How do we fix the problems? How do we really develop innovative ideas and behaviors? Really, it's a design focus, really meant to eliminate or reduce these problems. But still, it's problem-focused. The two other are, it's one of the constructive forms of media, but and news, but the two others are quite different and I think new to this whole idea of media literacy. So the third cornerstone of this model is about community-generated news. It's that basically communities, when they come together and dialogue, they can generate stories. And they, if they ask a fifth question, not a fact-based question that happens with critical news or problem-focused news, which again is about who, what, where, and when, if they ask a fifth question, which is really beyond those four fact-based questions, about how could this have been different, they start to really explore possibilities as a community, then that community in its own dialogue process can generate its own news. It can begin to think about behavior it wants for its community. And that's the first of the possibility-focused media. And then finally, the fourth cornerstone is, how do we really move into common states of collective knowing about our common and greater good, that we're part of something that our democracy in particular, how do we open to trust each other in our collective connection and our collective intelligence? And this fourth kind of media and news really underline our common condition and our shared needs for liberty and equality and community. That tends to be, that which connects us tends to be the arts. So that media form is more art-driven and art-infused. And that really drives a collective knowing, a wisdom-based understanding of what some people would call more of a soul-based activism when it's really art-infused. So those four forms together, certainly critical media, solution-based, community-generated news, and the common and greater connection news, those are what we're outlining, and our stories tend to come packaging one or more of these typically types of stories and media forms.
So, Bethany Surface, let's bring you in, a student at San Francisco State University and working, of course, with the Project Censored Club there. You are co-presidents there, right?
Yes.
With Audrey Johnson and, of course, Amber Yang, who was on the program here before. Why don't you tell us a little bit about a couple of the stories that you were researching for Project Censored, one on how Norway avoided becoming a fascist state, and then the other on mindfulness training working better than antidepressant drugs. Talk to us a little bit about the process and about some of these stories.
Definitely. So just to kind of segue onto what Ken was talking about how we need to kind of shift our perceptual field and how we tend to just naturally gravitate towards, you know, the negative things and the harmful things in order to protect ourselves. And so shifting away from that, I found a few incredible stories about how mindfulness training, specifically mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, was just as effective at alleviating depressive symptoms. And I thought that was incredibly important, especially for this semester in our research, just because so many things that have gone on over this last year and in our lives and that will continue to go on with this presidency, they do evoke these awful and depressive emotions in us. And it's hard to kind of navigate through what we're feeling internally as well as what we're experiencing externally. And so the story that I found really hit home for me. And so I wanted to write it up really well. And I'm glad that I got a chance to submit it. And essentially what they did with these patients is they used an analogy of a traumatic dog attack. And so they instructed these people that were experiencing these depressive symptoms to feel them as thoughts and not facts. So to kind of be mindful of that these are feelings in this current state and not of them as a whole being. And so I thought that was an incredibly valuable thing to just kind of put out there for people, because at the end of the day, everything is how we perceive it. And so if we can get away from this reactionary, fear-based kind of mode of thinking about things, then we can begin to open up to the beauty and the goodness. And, you know, it's empowering to be able to take these emotions and these fears and say, no, I'm not going to let that control me, you know. And so I'm just really grateful that I got an opportunity to kind of dig deep into these stories and submit them, because I think it goes hand in hand with what we're trying to do at SF State with this critical media literacy and trying to promote the goodness and the beauty that, you know, is in life. I mean, it's 2017, you know, life can be pretty good. sometimes if we just choose to appreciate the good.
Ken Burroughs, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bethany, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, that's my story.
Well, Ken Burroughs, tie that in to the four themes.
Well, basically, just a reminder that constructive media is not just a feel-good approach. It's not a new age or feel better. It's really a getting better kind of approach. It's literally looking at innovative thinking that imagination is subversive. It tends to arise from a place beyond social conditioning. So the stories we're finding really tend to break the social mode. So instead of innovation is really about doing something different instead of trying to just do the same thing better all the time. So the stories like the one that she was just talking about is really game-changing in how to actually begin to manipulate the very thoughts that are perhaps setting up part of the depressive state. And I'm not sure if she announced this, but it's actually as effective or more effective than any of the drug therapies. And these are long-term. People have tried every drug in the book trying to really change their depressive states. And to change their thinking was found to be more effective. So in a way, it's circling right back to what we're saying. We need a different way of thinking as a people. We're stuck in this negativity bias, which is the biological term for being trapped in fear and not knowing really a way out of that defensiveness.
Ken Burroughs, this is Peter Phillips. I really like this idea of constructive media and your basic categories of new voices and how do we condition ourselves in states of collective knowing. I mean, this is very important. Inside of corporate media today, however, it seems that a lot of the negativity, the fear-based thinking, is pretty deliberate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's corporate media is telling us to be fearful. They want us to, you know, support, you know, a police state, literally. If not, you know, the terrorists are going to get us or the criminals are going to get us. How do we address that in a broader way than just classrooms?
I think everyone should learn about the negativity bias itself, this biological bias we have toward threat. So if we can be aware that when we're trapped in those, we're really shaped by our perceived threats, whether they're real or unreal. And so this leads to two core mistakes, overestimating the problems and really underestimating the resources and the possibilities. So if we can understand we'll be able to find our way through some of this propaganda much more effectively if we can see that this is human nature and we're just being tricked. We're overestimating problems. We're being set up through the propaganda machine to really think certain ways that are in this negative bias. We have to understand we're in those thought traps, and fear-based thinking is dominating our cultural perspective. So just becoming aware of it, we're less likely to be trapped.
So, Bethany Surface, we know you have to leave here momentarily, but we just wanted to bring you back in, and then we're going to shift gears. But we wanted to ask if you had any other final thoughts and if you wanted to share anything that you had in terms of your experiences during the research.
Definitely, yeah. This experience was definitely life-changing over this last semester and the previous fall semester, just seeing how the community at SF State really reacted to what we were doing in the club. We got a chance to do a showcase for the College of Health and Social Services, and we just received with such great fascination. Like, everyone was just so thankful that we were doing what we're doing, and I just wanted to say thank you to you guys for keeping this going for as long as you have and allowing students each semester to filter in and out and be changed and make change. You know, it's a beautiful process, and I look forward to continuing it, and I look forward to being on the radio show some more. This is an incredible experience.
Well, it's great to have you, Bethany, and thanks so much for the work that you're doing at San Francisco State with Ken Burroughs. And Bethany Surface, I'm sure we'll have you back on the program again in the near future.
Definitely. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, so let's turn our attention to you, Malcolm Pinson. You were working on a number of stories for Project Censored, including on police brutality and measures that could be implemented to change, to reduce, basically to change police culture. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so I chose this police brutality one because it's like I'm a African-American male, and I've seen a lot of people of my demographic and people that look like me being killed by the police just in cold blood and open, and police officers not getting any like, they're not getting punished for it. They get paid leave. And I just wanted to, like, dig deeper into this to see what we can do to fix these problems. So the story I did was, it was about a study done. It was after the Ferguson killing. It was a group called the Zero Project. The police used for a force project. So there's this organization that looked into what can be done to help prevent police brutalities. And they surveyed 91 of the 100 largest cities in the United States. And they surveyed their police department and looked at their strategies and their tactics that they used. And they realized that there's 8 different policies that could be used that are not implemented in all of these police departments. And these are very, very, like, simple policies that can be done that could reduce violence. And if all of these police departments were to utilize these 8 policies, then police killings could drop by 72% across the nation.
That's pretty amazing, Malcolm. Can you tell us what some of these are?
Yeah, some of the policies, like I said, they're very, very, like, simple and easy to follow. So some of them restrict chokeholds, require officers to give verbal warnings, prohibit officers from shooting at moving vehicles, limit the kinds of force that can be used to respond specific forms of resistance, require comprehensive reporting, require officers to stop colleagues from exercising excessive force. Just simple things like that that are usually overlooked because many of these officers don't have, like, the correct supervision, and they're usually just able to do whatever they want.
Right, and of course, the way media often cover and frame these, right, there's not a lot of depth or pointing out of any of these kind of things. Peter Phillips, you've certainly researched this and looked at this issue of police violence in the past.
Certainly, and what we're finding, of course, is when police officers do kill people, that there's a consolidation of support for the individual officers. There's a repression of information, and the families are threatened, literally, or sometimes isolated and brought to the jail and not told that their loved ones have even died. There's some really bad abuses, and we interviewed 14 families in the San Francisco Bay Area at that time. Now, since then, we've seen some, you know, positive improvements. Like, Salt Lake City has implemented a lot of these, and they haven't had a police shooting there where someone has died in 4 years. So, I mean, there's opportunities to make these kinds of changes. Is that how you are hoping to see this implemented?
Well, yeah, because you just said they haven't had a killing in 4 years, so it shows how effective these policies can be. And if they're all implemented throughout the United States, then we would see less police killings across the nation.
So that's Malcolm Pinson, a student at San Francisco State University, who was researching 8 policies that prevent police brutality, and that research is on projectcensored.org, one of the stories that we're researching for the next book cycle. We're also joined by Ken Burrows, who teaches at San Francisco State University and helps to shepherd and work with students for the San Francisco State Project Censored group. After the musical break, we'll be joined by another student, Audrey Johnson, and we'll continue our conversation about constructive media literacy. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On this segment of the program, we're talking about constructive media literacy, and we're joined by Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University, who helps run research for San Francisco State's Project Censored Club. We're also joined now by Malcolm Pinson. We were just speaking with Malcolm before the break on 8 policies that prevent police brutality. And we're now joined by another San Francisco State student, Audrey Johnson. And Audrey, you're going to talk to us about one of your stories, right? Citizen Science in the Age of Alternative Facts. Tell us a little bit about your research at San Francisco State, Audrey.
Yes, exactly, Mickey. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I love talking Project Censored with everyone here. But yeah, it's been, you know, in today's age of alternative facts, you know, everything, you can't know what to believe. And it's really great. NASA has this GLOBE program that they have been in existence for 20 years now, and they just launched a new app in August, and it allows citizens like ourselves to use this app and collect data through photographs that gets sent directly to these scientists, helping in their efforts to, you know, further their research in climate change, which is very hard to do, especially with the gag orders that Trump has been putting on all the climate change scientists lately. And it's just a really great thing. You know, they use this, they call it crowdsourcing technology, which is basically how you can take, you know, this an app basically and just crowdsource everyone to participate, which is really amazing because we can all then be scientists today and contribute to the research, which is really important. But they are also using the crowdsourcing on other things. Right now, what NASA's using it for is to take photographs of clouds, the underneath of clouds, which, you know, from satellites, you cannot really get a very good view of the underneath. So they figure people is a really great way to take photographs and see how these clouds are changing over time. And all of this is driven by, you know, affordable computer technology. Everybody has a smartphone nowadays, and they have cameras in them. They have GPS in them, which is very important for, you know, scientists having these collections on location. Where are these, you know, photographs? Where are these things being collected is also very important. And just in general, citizen scientists play a really crucial role in connecting people to nature. And actually coming up on June 5th is World Environmental Day. And this is where crowdsourcing is really amazing because people can, on that day, you know, use their technology to post photos of the nature of things and actually get sent to scientists who will analyze, you know, analyze these photos and even put a name to whatever the species or genus that they're taking a photo of. And it's really amazing.
So Audrey Johnson, tell us, in your opinion, you know, what have you been experiencing through this process of research and working with Ken Burrows at Project Censored? And you're co-president of the San Francisco State Club there with Bethany Surface, who just joined us a little bit ago on the program. And of course, we're here with Malcolm Pinson. What are you taking with you from these experiences? I mean, other than the specificity of the stories you're researching, how else do you think this is empowering you in your education and in terms of civic engagement?
Everybody wants to be informed. The consumer nowadays wants to be informed about everything. And I think that it's our job to investigate that and to really look into these things that can be questionable. And I think being a part of Project Censored has just really shown me, you know, the power of self-organizing and the power that the people have to take back that, you know, to take back the media. And I think that that's a really empowering tool just to be a part of a community that, you know, really cares about these things just like I do.
So Malcolm Pinson, same question to you, right? How is this, do you feel, how is this empowering you in any way? And how do you feel this is working more towards civic engagement and something that, you know, in your future?
I'm a broadcasting major at SF State, so this is right down my field. So when I learned about Project Censored in the fall semester of last year, when I took Ken's class, it really piqued my interest. And I think this club really just helped me question mainstream media, because usually, like before then, I would just watch what's on the news and just believe everything. But when you really look deeper and you can see what stories they're not covering, it really shows like what they're what their bias is and how they just go for ratings at the end of the day and not really to inform the people. So I think that's the main thing I'm taking away from this.
Yeah, and that's actually the critical media literacy element of it, right? Mm-hmm. Is that in terms of broadcasting, you're not just learning about tools and, you know, procedures and the profession itself. You're also approaching this from, as Ken pointed out, one of the first steps in the constructive media literacy platform is understanding the nature of the problems and then going through the other steps, right? And so that's a really big thing. And for you, in terms of a broadcasting major, going through that, you know, I believe that you're getting a lot more, you know, out of what you can make out of that career, and you yourself will be a vehicle for transforming and changing that, just like Audrey was saying moments ago.
Yeah, exactly. That's the plan. I definitely want to change the way that the news is being projected and the way that they're telling stories, because many of the stories are just kind of irrelevant or just fillers to make the audience feel happy or to scare them about a car robbery in the city or whatever, when you could be facing bigger problems that could actually help out the community.
Malcolm and Audrey, for sources of news, what are you learning that are sources that you think are important and that you can trust?
I love Yes Magazine. I think it's the greatest thing that we have as a resource. And I love the fact that they don't put out an issue until they have, you know, enough or adequate, you know, story to put out, and not just producing something for the sake of, you know, putting something out there on time for people to read.
And we're fans of Sarah Van Gelder. She did the intro to our 2014 book. My associate director, Andy Roth, writes book reviews there. And, of course, Yes, long-standing force for good news and solutions kind of journalism. So it's great to hear that you also find affinity with Yes. How about you, Malcolm?
Yeah, I would also say Yes Magazine as well. I know Ken sent us a whole email of, like, 8 different sources that we could go to. So Yes Magazine is definitely one. I definitely also check out the Project Censored website to see what other people are writing about across the nation, what other students are writing about, and where they get their sources from. So I also like to check that place out as well, that website.
Indeed. And Ken Burroughs, let's bring you in to wrap up the segment. Some of your thoughts about this. Again, you're always bringing amazing students onto the program, and we're really happy that we're able to have this platform to share the kind of work that you're doing, because you're just another example of the professors and students across the country. We're on about 20 campuses, but SF State has consistently been one of the strongest contributors. And again, a lot of that is on you and the students. And I would just like to hear some of your concluding thoughts on constructive media literacy and the work your students are doing.
Well, I'm glad to add a final thought. I think of George Gerbner. Before he passed away in 2005, I remember he said something like, "Who tells the stories of a culture really governs human behavior." And it used to be the parent, the school, the church, the community. Now it's a handful of global conglomerates that really, they don't have anything to tell. They just have a lot to sell. So I think most of our news, which is corporate news, is more about what is shaping our minds in ways that are really not appropriate. This problem-fixed and focused journalism fails to cover the vast amount of human behavior that tends to be collaborative and caring. And so where's the empowering news that highlights the best in human nature and our goodness and our creativity? We'd like to see more of those stories and that news articulated, and we're going to keep focusing on this as a future orientation for our work.
Well, Ken Burroughs, thanks again for coming back on the Project Censored Show, talking about constructive media literacy. We also heard from Bethany Surface, Malcolm Pinson, and Audrey Johnson, all students at San Francisco State working with the Project Censored Club there. Again, always a pleasure to hear updates from you, and always fantastic to have students on the program talking about all the things that they're not only learning, but the things that they're directly contributing. And listeners can learn more about the work that the students are doing as we publish it online at projectcensored.org. as well at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, GCML.org. So thanks to all of you for joining the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you for having me.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks. Take care. Up next on the Project Censored Show, Peter and I will talk with Chase Palmieri. We'll get an update from Tribeworthy at Tribeworthy.com. We'll shift from constructive media literacy to crowd-contested media. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Well, the last segment, we talked about constructive media literacy, and we talked about the work students and professors do researching and validating independent news, as well as providing solutions kinds of journalism. And we're now joined in the segment, I should say we're rejoined on the Project Censored Show by Chase Palmieri, who's the founder of TribeWorthy.com in what he defines, or he calls, contested or crowd-contested media. And Chase Palmieri is going to talk to us more about what's happening with TribeWorthy, a new startup. The last 6 months, they've been revamping and they've been reworking their site and working with students, professors, and others around the country. And they are relaunching their project. And I want Chase Palmieri to tell us again, what exactly is TribeWorthy? And how did you come about with this idea? And then, well, while you're talking to us, Chase, about how you came about with this idea, talk a little bit about the challenge or the problem that you're trying to address. Chase, so welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey. Thanks for having us back. Yeah, I'll be speaking on behalf of TribeWorthy today, and our main goal is to connect people to the most trusted information online. And when we say trusted, we don't mean based on algorithms or anything like that. What we're talking about is real human trust. And so in order for us to get that data, which we can then display back to users, we are doing what's called crowd-contested media, as you just said. And basically what that means is that we're allowing users to review online news articles on our platform. And so they're not saying whether an online article is true or false. What they're doing is they're warning each other. They're working together to point out logical fallacies, biases, mistakes. They're rating how newsworthy that topic is. They're identifying a headline as clickbait. Basically, every action that we wish we could take when wanting to hold these online authors and outlets accountable, you can now do on the TribeWorthy platform.
So, Chase, it's been described here as kind of like a Yelp or a Rotten Tomatoes for news sources, and that ties into your crowd-contested media definition. Can you talk a little bit more about that and about the model for TribeWorthy?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, me and my founding team, we're really frustrated with the quality of online journalism, as many of us are today, and we're especially frustrated with the lack of accountability throughout news media. And so we were looking to models like Rotten Tomatoes and Yelp, and we were wondering, why is it that in today's world, when everybody is experiencing trust online by seeing the unincentivized feedback of their peers and seeing what their friends and peers are saying about a particular product or service, why isn't this concept being deployed against online news? And so we started to think, and we all come from different political backgrounds and ideologies, so we were trying to come up with a review process that took political bias out of the equation, and really what we ended up with was a review process that used critical media literacy. And basically, what you're doing when you're on our platform is you'll read an article, and you will review an article, and you can give it, you can reward the article saying that you trust it, or you can quickly, within one or two clicks, identify problems, the main problem that you had with that article, and then write down an explanation for how you found that problem to be within that article. And so then other users can come and see what the feedback is on these online articles. And so really, a lot of people today are getting their news from Facebook, and it makes sense when you think about the fact that trust is built online today by seeing that feedback from your peers. And at the same time, we know that Facebook was not built to be a platform for news consumers. It's much more of a social product. So what we're doing at TribeWorthy is we're taking all the best aspects of this kind of peer-reviewed news platform, and we've built a platform that's just specifically for news consumers.
So, Chase Palmieri, the website is TribeWorthy.com. You mentioned Facebook not being a news source or a journalistic source. And in fact, after the last presidential election, that's where we heard a lot of cries about so-called fake news and proliferation and algorithm confirmation bias issues. And there was a lot of ire and attention paid toward places like Google and Facebook. And Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook's reaction initially was to kind of laugh that off. until, you know, it was made known that this was something that the public held to be very serious, and even the current iteration of fake news, as it's so called, was specifically talking to bogus stories that proliferate wildly on the internet. Not necessarily a broader definition that we've used at Project Censored about propaganda, but at any rate, the Facebook answer to this stuff was algorithms and fact-checking. What's Tribeworthy's response to that approach?
Well, to be fair to Facebook, they never intended to be a news platform. I mean, even in the earliest days of Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm room, it was much more of a social gathering platform. Their initial goal was to bring the college experience online. And so if that is the base of your platform, well, you can see how the fact that many people use it as a news gathering platform is probably not ideal. And I think they're taking some of the right steps. They're bringing in third-party fact-checking like Snopes and PolitiFact, and they're tagging those onto articles.
Which also have problems, but we can get into that later.
Right. Actually, I was just going to get into that.
Oh, good. Please do.
So the reason that fact-checking organizations aren't the solution to this problem, and again, if they were the solution to this problem, we would have already solved the problem. The reason that they aren't an adequate solution is that they can't scale to address every article on the internet. And the only type of platform that could possibly succeed in doing so would have to be powered by users. And so that's really what we're trying to do, is we're empowering people throughout the internet and eventually, hopefully globally, to finally be able to talk back and provide the feedback to these journalists and these news outlets that they're not getting. And if you think about it, it's beneficial to the journalists and the news outlets themselves, because what are they relying on right now? They're relying on traffic metrics like likes and shares and click-through and advertising revenue. And when you think about it, none of those metrics are in the public's best interest, but none of them tell the story of a user's experience either. So the New York Times might look at their traffic metrics today, and they'll have no idea where they lost the trust of a user. But now they would be able to go to Tribeworthy, and they would be able to see, okay, this user lost trust with us because we used this type of logical fallacy in one of our arguments, and now we know that that author uses that type of logical fallacy on occasion, and it's something that we can work to weed out of our reporting.
Chase, this is Peter Phillips. What's your goal here in terms of involvement? Is it unlimited? Thousands and thousands of people reviewing stories, and then you're looking for if they're trusted, a 70% scoring in terms of positive. And how are stories selected?
Okay, great question. So as far as who we want on the platform, for listeners, I would think of it as you would Yelp. Yelp doesn't discriminate who can come onto the platform, but they have monitoring tools in place to make sure that you have one account on the platform and that your review only counts as one review. So I would say that that's our approach, because we do want to bring in people from all different sides of the country, all different political spectrums into this, to have a debate based on objectivity and the logic in these news articles. What was the second part of the question?
Well, your source of news articles. So if I have a news article I picked up from Truth Out, and I think it's pretty good, and can I submit it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a user-generated platform. So as of right now, we are scraping some articles. We are pulling articles onto the platform to be reviewed by users, just to help populate things as we launch. But users can post their own articles, and they can actually review the article as they're posting it onto the platform.
So, Chase Palmieri at Tribeworthy.com, this sounds ideal, of course, for educators and students in terms of uploading news stories. In the last segment, we were talking to Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University and several of his students about the work they do. And Malcolm Pinson is actually in the studio with us here. And you know Malcolm, and I know that Tribeworthy has been to San Francisco State and shown students and everyone there what you're all doing and how they get involved. I was curious just to bring Malcolm into the conversation here briefly. You know, Malcolm, as a fellow millennial with Chase and as a student in broadcasting, what are your thoughts about this kind of endeavor?
I think it's a really good idea, because I know people my age are really looking for news and looking for reliable news sources. And like Chase mentioned, a lot of people get the news from social media and Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, which, I mean, I guess it's relevant if it's for like sporting games and stuff. But if you want real news about like certain problems going on in the world, you're not going to really find legitimate news sources from on social media. So I think it's a really good idea. But I have a question too. How do you plan on outreaching this, like getting this out to people that aren't like necessarily like looking for reliable news sources? Like, how are you going to get people to make sure that to tune into this, even though they're not necessarily interested in, like, how do you, I don't know, how do
or
you
news get, literacy,
yeah,
right?
News literacy. Yeah. How do you get people that are interested, that, how are you going to bring this to people that are not interested into news literacy? Like, how are you going to
How are people that don't know they're looking for it going to find it, Chase Palmieri?
That's a great question. And it actually is obviously one of our great challenges ahead of us. The key thing that we're looking at is we are identifying three different types of users. So, and we've classified these users as the reviewer persona, the time saver persona, and the observer. And so I'll just briefly touch on what those different types of users are and how we kind of need to bring on one user group at a time to really achieve the scaling success that we need. So the first users that we're going after are these people that would ideally like to review these online articles, and that would be the reviewer persona. And so once we reach a certain level of reviews, it creates these pages, a rating page for each of the articles that you would then see in search results. So other people that are unsure, that would be the observer, that are unsure about whether or not they should trust a particular article or not, or maybe there's a discussion or heated discussion going on in the comment section on Reddit or even on the article itself, people can throw the article rating page in there to add to the discussion and be like, look, everybody on Tribeworthy is saying that this article has a red herring fallacy. There seems to be a lot of agreement that is a problem within this article. So then you have the observers. Just like on Rotten Tomatoes, there are reviewers that actually review the movies. But most of us are actually just observers. We go to the site when we want to see what movies are out in theaters and what's worth engaging with. So this, it would be similar to our platform as well. You're going to have reviewers that create the ratings. And obviously anybody can become a reviewer, but we don't expect everyone to want to review online articles. But those that do review the articles, they're creating a rating page that others can then reference when deciding where to gather their news from. And then when you put all that together and those build upon each other, then you get to the third type of user persona, which is the time saver. And that's somebody that would want to come to our platform because they don't have much time, but they want to catch up on the news. And they don't necessarily want to just read whatever online articles are in their Facebook feed or have been shared to them. They want to be able to quickly find the most trusted and newsworthy articles of the day. And so that's where we ultimately achieve scale, is when people are using our platform as a first stop place to quickly find the most trusted and newsworthy stories of the day.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned in to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Right now, we're speaking with Chase Palmieri of Tribeworthy.com. We're also still joined from the last segment of the show by Malcolm Pinson, who's a student at San Francisco State working with the Project Censored Club there. And we will continue our conversation about Tribeworthy.com, crowd-contested media, after this break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of the show, we've been talking about crowd-contested media and talking about the launch of a startup called Tribeworthy.com. We're joined by Chase Palmieri at Tribeworthy. For full disclosure, I want listeners to know that I've been consulting with the organization for about the last half year, particularly about the critical media literacy education components. It was when I first came across Tribeworthy.com. I believed strongly that this was a fascinating idea, as particularly a way, as a tool for the younger generation, more the digital natives, so-called, to really try to build trust among news sources. And that's a term, digital natives, is one that's used about millennials that are growing up with the technology. So there's an assumption that they automatically kind of understand how to navigate the internet and understand how to use digital and technological sources. But one of the key elements to add to that is that doesn't mean that critical thinking education goes along with it. And one of the great things I think about Tribeworthy is it's fusing these things, that it's creating a platform that's very friendly for millennials, and including going to have a browser application coming up. But also, it's a way for people, as Malcolm Pinson said earlier, it's a way for people to share sources, a way for people to build trust among sources, and also a great way to even talk amongst ourselves about how do we share this idea, like how did Yelp become a big thing such that you can't even avoid it, or Rotten Tomatoes. If you try to look up any kind of a movie anywhere, the Rotten Tomatoes rating is right there. Yeah. Imagine if something like Tribeworthy was there for these kinds of news sources. So this is what we're talking with Chase Palmieri about. And Peter, you have a great question for Chase.
Chase, I see right on your statement about Tribeworthy, it says we are not a fact-checking organization. However, it would seem to me that reviewers could in fact say that this fact is wrong or that, but that would be a combination of the reviewing process, and you call that crowd-contested media. So facts will still be a part of all of this, correct?
Correct. So just to clarify that point, what we mean when we say Tribeworthy is not a fact-checking organization, we're saying that because we, as a company ourselves, do not investigate claims or make claims ourselves. Similar to how Yelp doesn't say, this is a great restaurant, you're going to have a five-star experience here. They're just displaying feedback from the crowd, and hopefully that helps guide your decision-making process.
Well, Chase, also want to call attention to the fact that the website has an educators page, a frequently asked questions page, and of course, one of the frequently asked questions at a number of the events that we've done and that you've done about, you know, speaking about the project is people say, well, how do you deal with so-called trolls or trolling or bots or people that want to target it and bolster a particular source over another or take down a certain source over another? How do you have systems in place to address those kinds of challenges online?
Yeah, that's absolutely always the first question people ask. So we built into the product ways to mitigate the risk of this. So the first is on our rating, we're only displaying the top three most reviewed problems with each article. So not every reviewed problem of an article gets displayed to the users on the rating page, just the top three. So that means that in order for these trolls or people that are trying to come on and have a negative impact on an article without cause, they would have to organize together in a way in real numbers and then review an article in exactly the same way. And so we have monitoring tools that will be able to show us when a large group of users out of the norm organizes together, reviews an article in the exact same way. That's something that we have monitoring tools in place to mitigate against. The other thing is that, remember, this is the lifetime URL of an article. So although we do want to have a quality rating while the news is relevant, at the end of the day, these rating pages and these reviews are associated with that article for the entire existence it is online. So trolls might come on in a certain week or day, and they might have an incentive to try to bring down a rating at that specific time. But overall, throughout the entire existence of that article on the internet, we believe that the quality reviews will win out. We're also doing things to make sure that people are not creating multiple accounts from the same location. So we have all these basic checks in place as you would with any other consumer review platform.
So let's bring you back into the conversation, Malcolm Pinson.
Yeah, so Mickey was talking about how this is mainly for the digital natives and the younger, like, millennial generation. I was wondering, how do you plan on targeting the older generations and people that might not be so tech savvy?
Our strategy for those types of users would probably be by reaching out to specific journalists that they trust. So we actually hope that this review process will incentivize or align the interests of news consumers and news producers, because people that are producing high-quality content will finally be able to stand out and stand above other journalists in the field. So what we want to do is we want to identify journalists that are highly trusted from users on the platform and touch on them and hopefully turn them into influencers on the platform. And one thing that we're doing for this is similar to how Rotten Tomatoes has a critics category as well as the audience category. We will have the tribe category, which is just our general users, but we're eventually going to introduce our journalist category. So ideally, in the future, you'll be able to go to an article and you'll be able to see, oh, Glenn Greenwald reviewed this article by the New York Times. What did he have to say about it? And you would be able to do this and follow particular journalists that you trust. And you can actually read the news together with some of the people that you look up to or you trust in the news ecosystem.
And certainly, again, I want to point out the educator element of this. And there's an education page that talks about critical media literacy. And it talks about various kinds of class exercises and tells educators how they can get along. This is a great tool, by the way, for having students upload stories that they might be researching. Let's say that it's validated independent news stories for Project Censored, just as an example. The rest of the class can go on and rate stories, or the teachers can look and see what they're doing. And it's a great tool to generate conversation. Right. And I think also just to simply call awareness that earlier in the program, Malcolm, you mentioned about broadcasting and about how prior to getting involved with Project Censored, you know, you kind of watch the corporate media, you kind of take it in, maybe you'd see both sides of an issue. And then later, you know, after thinking about critical media literacy education and the tenets of it, you realize, well, maybe there's more than two sides. And what's the story behind the story? Right.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity to create conversation in the culture about how we get our information. And Tribeworthy.com is basically a public platform where anybody can go and upload stories and anybody can opine or comment on these kinds of stories. So, Chase Palmieri, how do people get involved with Tribeworthy and support Tribeworthy?
So Tribeworthy has been, for the last few months, we've been underground testing our beta with a small group of users, really fine-tuning the product. But we're going to be launching the newest version of the product the week of June 12th, so just coming up. And what you can do is you can come to tribeworthy.com. You'll see the landing page. It'll ask you to create your account, and you'll come in, and you can start reviewing articles and viewing rating pages right away. One thing that you just said that kind of gave me an interesting thought is right now when people try to prove their points or they get into arguments about a specific policy or a news article, people quickly search online and anybody can find an article that supports their position. And so somebody can show you an article from a small online news blog, and somebody can show you an article from the Wall Street Journal, and they're both publications, so there's no way of saying, oh, your information is more accurate than mine. But now what you would be able to do is you'd be able to go see the rating for each of these articles, and you'd be able to say, well, this article has a 90% Tribeworthy rating, and this other article is highly contested, and many people are finding problems with it. These two news articles are not, in fact, created equal. And so that's something that we're really interested in used throughout the internet.
Okay, well, Chase Palmieri, that wraps up this segment of the Project Censored show today. So thanks again for returning to the program and talking about Tribeworthy.com and the new relaunch effort that's recently underway.
Thank you so much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, co-hosts and executive producers. We're also here with our producer Anthony Fest. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on about 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York, To learn more about Project Censored and the work we do, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
By the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times where the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love of the brothers and our sisters. Lift up.